Morning, everybody. I'm sitting in this morning for Tim, who's not feeling well this morning. So I'd like to talk about six key elements that people need in order to thrive spiritually. MZMC's been doing some strategic planning lately, and last Thursday I was in a meeting in which we were talking about strategic planning, core values, visioning, things like that. And afterwards, when I was on my way home, I started thinking about all the different Zen centers that I've ever been to and what makes each one of them different or unique. And, I could come up with things to say about each one that was different than the other ones. But then when I got home, I found something that reminded me of how our missions are really all very similar. And through one of those kind of serendipitous things that happened, I got home and I had an email waiting from the Benedictine Sisters of St. Paul's Monastery in Maplewood. And if you know the Benedictine nuns at all, you won't be surprised that they had some things to say that were very much in tune with our Zen practice. They're kind of like that, I think. So they were doing some strategic planning themselves. And in the middle of that, they decided to test their assumptions about what it was that brought people to their place, what it was that people are seeking when they went there. And they so they did a survey. And one of the questions that they asked was, what do people need in order to thrive spiritually today? And after a couple of rounds of asking more questions about that, they identified what they believed were six key elements that people need in order to thrive spiritually. And since Zen people really love lists, I thought, well, this is really cool. It's cool. A list, oh boy. So they said that they were really intrigued by what people came up with. And they were also very intrigued what was not on the list, what didn't come up, and also by the language that people used to describe these needs. And what intrigued me, of course, was how well it tracks to our practice here at MZMC, and also at every other Zen center I've been to, I think. So on the cover of your bulletin, I listed the six elements. And this is what they are. The first one is times of silence and solitude. A community that welcomes all people wherever they are on their spiritual journey and spiritual practices. Cultivating a sense of joy and gratitude. Authenticity, to be true and real in one's relationships with all beings and with one's own spiritual practices. To appreciate one's own humanity and the humanity of others through a heart of wisdom and compassion. And spiritual companions, both one-on-one and in groups, who can listen as we go deeply. I did tweak the language slightly on these, but a whole lot less than you would think. A whole lot less than you would think. So there were a few things that I sort of translated into Zen. So I want to talk about each one of those today. The first one, times of silence and solitude. You know, nothing is more important to Zen practice than this. Nothing is more important than that. We have our short periods of our daily meditation practice, and we've also got longer periods of extended meditation that we do in our retreats, anywhere from half a day. We have half-day sessions all the way up to seven-day retreats. Zen practice is really very simple that way. Meditation is our core practice. It's our core practice. And it's very simple. couple of months ago, Dokai Jorgensen was here, and he said, it's simple, but it's not easy. And that's true. I think the hardest part is that we don't want to sit down and do it. We don't want to. So it's a real common thing when people start off in Zen practice that they start out by reading books and books and books and books. And, you know, they can be fascinating and really helpful, but if you haven't actually steeped yourself in sitting, they can also be really frustrating because you can see that there's something there, but you can't really get it by reading. When I was first reading about Zen, I noticed that there's something there. I can really tell there's something there, but I don't get it. And so I just read more and more and more and more. And then finally I decided that if I was going to get this, I was going to have to actually do the practice. And then, of course, after a few years of that, I realized that there's nothing to get. I'm glad I didn't know that at the outset. Ryokan, who's a Zen poet and monk, I think he's 18th century, had this wonderful quote. It said something like, until that time, I had depended merely upon my ability. And it really struck me, merely upon my ability. So, you know, usually we think of our efforts being dependent entirely upon our ability. So he's implying there that there's something else that we can depend on. Or maybe that there isn't something else that we can depend on. But I think he's talking about that deep inner silence that we aren't going to get in our day-to-day lives. I think for most of us, the only way that we're going to have that kind of deep inner silence is by sitting. And I think that we don't need ability per se. I think we don't need ability in order to meditate. You know, you don't need to be good at meditation, whatever good at meditation means, in order to meditate. I have a friend who told me that she so admires people who meditate regularly, but that she couldn't possibly do it because she's too antsy. And I think she meant antsy, you know, in her mind, that she had too busy of a mind. But you don't need a silent, quiet, calm, equanimous mind in order to meditate. So we don't need to get up and go if any of us don't have that all the time. You may... all you really need, I think, is the desire, or sometimes I think of it as the inmost request. You need that desire. And you may not even know what the desire is for. You know, what is it you're looking for? You know, or you may think that you're looking for, you know, inner quiet or peace or clarity. Or you may not even be able to articulate it. You may not know what it is exactly that you're looking for, but you'll be surprised at what you find, I think. But in order to do that, you really need those regular periods of silence. So that's the first one, times of silence and solitude. And I would add solitude both alone and with others. And I'm going to talk about that more in a little bit. The second one is a community that welcomes all people wherever they are on their spiritual journey and spiritual practices. And the key word here for us is community or sangha. Now there's a story about how Ananda, Buddha's attendant, asked him whether it was true that good friends are fully half of the spiritual life. And Buddha replied, "No, Ananda. good spiritual friends are the whole of the holy life. Find refuge in the Sangha. The Sangha, or the community, it's what keeps us upright. It's what keeps us upright. And there's something about sitting together that I can't really explain what it is about sitting with other people. I've said this before. The best description I've ever heard of it is that it's like ducks flying in formation. You know, there's something aerodynamic about it. There's something that that we can't really explain that makes sitting together different than sitting on our own. So there's meditation here 6 days a week, 6 mornings and 3 evenings every week, and everyone's invited. And you're particularly invited to Wednesday evenings because that's when I'm the doshi, and I'd love to have you come sit with me. So Buddha invited and welcomed all kinds of people into his Sangha. Some of them had done years of one kind of spiritual practice or another, and others hadn't done any. You know, he had in his Sangha, there were people who were members of royalty, and there were people who had been notorious murderers. There were people who came in, you know, clear and joyous, and there were people who came in crazed with grief. There were all kinds of different folks. You know, some people, I've noticed this around here, some people come in once and then we never see them again, and other people stay for years and years and years and years. I was here during the week one time, during the day, and the doorbell rang, and there was a guy there, and he said that he was just passing, he'd been walking around the lake. He had been here a couple of years before for one of the intro sessions, and he said, and I've never been back. And he said, and I haven't meditated since then. And he was a little embarrassed about this. But he said, I got to tell you, it made a huge impression on me. And it really changed how I look at life. So he said, so today when I was walking around the lake, I just wanted to stop and if somebody was here to let you know how grateful I am for that. And it really moved me. You know, I think about him sometimes because I love sitting with people that I've known for years, people who have had this ongoing spiritual practice. But after he stopped by that day, it really made me appreciate also the people that I just see one time, because you just never know. You don't know. So I used to go to a Unitarian church years ago when I was younger, and one day I walked in and I ran into the minister on my way in the door, and he said, how are you? And instead of saying fine, I told him the truth. I don't know what came over me, but I said I am just really crabby and cranky and I'm in a really bad mood. And he said, well, then it's a good thing you're here this morning. He said, this is just the right place to be. And it really turned around my idea of sort of what I was doing there. So I think of that now sometimes, and I remind myself that we don't come here because we're the best Zen students in the universe. You know, we come because we need community in order to do this practice. So that's the second one, a community that welcomes all people wherever they are on their spiritual journey and spiritual practices. And the third one is cultivating a sense of joy and gratitude. And, you know, we don't talk about joy and gratitude much in Buddhism. It's you know, if you read Dogen and you can find a place where he talks about joy or gratitude, let me know. It's there, but it's not something that we talk about in a real explicit way. When we're in retreat, when I think about joy and gratitude, the first thing I think about is being in retreat at mealtime. Because the ones of you who have been on long retreat here are laughing. Because at mealtime during a retreat, first of all, it's the one thing you have to look forward to, right? But also, because we're sitting here and we're steeping ourselves, and we really are going very deeply, and we really are paying attention to every little thing, that mealtime becomes a real occasion of heartfelt gratitude. And it does not matter what the food is like. We're just so grateful to the cook who's cooked us this food. We're so grateful to the servers who come around and give us, you know, who serve us. We take such joy in every bite, and it's because we're paying attention to it. Every time I leave a longer retreat, I think about, you know, if I ate this way all the time, just imagine how different mealtimes would be if I ate this mindfully and with this kind of heart and attitude all the time. So the sense of joy and gratitude. I've been working for a number of years with the Divine Abodes. I think Tim talked about the Divine Abodes, the Brahma Viharas, a couple of weeks ago. And I took them up a number of years ago as sort of my personal spiritual practice. So it's loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, that's the joy in other people's happiness, and equanimity. And so cultivating those qualities is the thing that that I'm most interested in as a practice these days. And not because cultivating them makes you a good person or because they're easy, but really actually more because they're difficult. And a while ago, I realized that I needed to add two more to the list. This is probably about a year ago. I was actually on my way over here, and I was thinking about the Divine Abodes. And I thought, you know, two that I'd really like to add to that list, my own sort of viharas, would be open-heartedness and gratitude. And open-heartedness is closely related to joy, I think. I think it's it leads to joy. And I define it as the attitude of embracing everyone and everything we encounter, whether it's what we were looking for or not. Just having that open-hearted attitude towards everything that we encounter. So I was really pleased to see these two in particular on the list, cultivating a sense of joy and cultivating a sense of gratitude. There's a saying, days pass and the years vanish, and we walk sightless among miracles. How filled with awe is this place, and we did not know it. This practice of sitting quietly can help us know it. And when we know how filled with awe is this place, how can we be anything but filled with joy and gratitude? It just elicits joy and gratitude, just come up out of that spontaneously, I think. Sort of a free-flowing, open-hearted gratitude just for being here in the middle of this big old messy universe. So that's cultivating a sense of joy and gratitude. And the fourth one is authenticity, to be true and real in one's relationship with all beings and with one's own spiritual practices. So from a Zen point of view, I think this one's about not clinging. From a Zen point of view, real and true mean with all the overlay that we put on things stripped away, all of our mental formations stripped away. It doesn't mean becoming a Zen zombie. And it doesn't mean that we sort of are then free to blurt out whatever it is that we think, because this is authentic, this is true, so I'm going to say it, by God. But it means being true to the moment, true in the moment of whatever is happening right now. Not responding out of some planned idea of how we ought to be or how things ought to be different than the way they are, but responding according to the way that things actually are right now. Shinryu Suzuki had a wonderful quote about this. It was something like, Zen means making your best effort in every moment forever. And I think he was talking there about being authentic. And in order to do that, you need some clarity, I think. And when we have a sitting practice, you know, every day we sit down and things come up and up and up, and we keep coming back and coming back and coming back. And eventually we start seeing that these things that keep coming up and up and up are just our ideas and our fantasies and our dreams and our wishes and our hopes, stories that we tell ourselves. And somehow I think maybe we just wear ourselves down or get over ourselves after a while. But somehow out of that, a clarity emerges. But you can't go out looking for that clarity. You can't say, I'm going to sit down right now and I'm going to get clear and I'm going to get holy. You know, you just need to sit down and be quiet. You know, clarity is kind of shy, I think. It's impossible to be clear and true and real in the moment when you have a chaotic mind. So that's what we get. I even feel stupid about saying that's what we get from a sitting practice. We don't get anything from a sitting practice. But so that was number four, authenticity, being true and real. And the fifth one is to appreciate one's own humanity and the humanity of others through a heart of wisdom and compassion. Now, the original from the Benedictine said to appreciate one's own humanity and the humanity of others through a heart of compassion and love. And I thought that was wonderful. And it also reminded me of the Heart Sutra, which talks about the heart of great wisdom and compassion. The first translation that I learned of the Heart Sutra, the title was The Heart of Great Wisdom Beyond Wisdom. And, of course, what's beyond wisdom? I mean, there isn't anything beyond wisdom. But there's a kind of wisdom that's beyond, that transcends our ordinary idea of what wisdom is. And I think it's tied up with compassion. You know, the Heart Sutra describes the awakening that the Bodhisattva of compassion had when deeply practicing Prajnaparamita, or the perfection of wisdom. So it's the Bodhisattva of compassion talking about this great insight about emptiness that was developed after sitting of after a long period of deep sitting contemplating wisdom. So in Zen there's a long tradition about wisdom and compassion. You know, they go together like this, you know, like two hands together. You can't really separate them. Whenever I'm walking here or chanting or something, and I notice, you know, my hands start coming apart a little bit. Sometimes you need a little sloppy and your hands start going like this. The first thing I think about wisdom and compassion, and there's no separation. And the hands go back together. And you can say that compassion, some people say that compassion arises out of wisdom, but I think it's equally true to say that wisdom arises out of compassion. On Saturday mornings here, we do a guided meditation on loving kindness. It's one of the compassion practices. And one of the things that I learned after doing the compassion, loving kindness kind of meditations for years was that when we have that having compassion for another person arises from understanding that underneath our surface differences, our humanity is the same. You know, when someone else is in pain, we may not understand the particular pain that they're in at this moment, but we can respond out of that human understanding of what it's like to be in pain. So if I'm doing a loving kindness meditation for someone who is struggling with cancer, I don't know what that's like, but I know what it's like to have great pain and great struggle. And so the compassion arises out of understanding that it's not the particularity of the situation, but our common understanding of our human predicament that allows compassion to arise. So those particular circumstances aren't a barrier, but they're a way for us to come closer together. And I think that wisdom arises out of that. I've had more of an experience of wisdom arising out of compassion than an understanding of how compassion arises out of wisdom, actually, personally. So the sixth one, the last one, says that spiritual companions, both one-on-one and in groups, who can listen as we go deeply. And if you know the Benedictines at all, they follow the rule of Saint Benedict, which is a book that was written by Saint Benedict, and they base all of their spiritual practice on the writings in this book. And the book begins with the sentence. It begins by saying, "Listen carefully, my child, to these precepts and incline the ear of your heart." So the first thing in the rule of Saint Benedict is the word listen, and they take it very seriously. And I love that they say, incline the ear of your heart. You know, in practice period, one of the things that we do is everybody gets paired up with a buddy. And you stay with the same person for, 8 weeks, I think, of practice period. The group gets together once a week, and then once a week you either talk to your buddy on the phone, or some people contact each other via email. And it's really nice when you can make an appointment to get together with your buddy once a week. And what we'd... Hi, Viv. Viv has been my buddy before, and so has Cindy been my buddy. And nobody else is here, but anyway. Karen, I'm sorry, the person right in front of me has been my buddy. Such a deep part of me that you just don't seem like a separate person. So we have these people that we pair up with, and usually they're people that we start out not knowing at all, or not knowing very well, certainly. But by the end of practice period, there's a real closeness that develops between the buddies, because what we do when we get together is we're talking about the text, we're talking about what we've been doing in practice period, we're talking about how things are going, and the conversations get very heartfelt and they can get very deep. And we also listen to somebody else in a way that maybe we ordinarily don't listen in such a heartfelt way, and we also can feel very listened to by this other person. So it's really an extraordinary thing. And in Zen practice, of course, we also get to know people we can become really deep spiritual companions to each other without saying a word to each other. We can sit right next to people for a week in retreat who maybe all we know about them is their name when we sit down. And we don't talk to them all week. We don't even really look at each other. But by the end of retreat, by the end of that time, you'll feel this real closeness to the person that you've been sitting next to that I can't really quite articulate. A week ago, I went to North Carolina for a gathering of Zen sewing teachers, and one of the women there was somebody who I had sat next to at San Francisco Zen Center for a week-long sesshin about 7 years ago. And we sat next to each other all week. And before the retreat, I was introduced to her because I know her husband pretty well. So I met her beforehand, but we didn't really talk. We sat next to each other the whole week. And I've run into her a couple of times since then at one Zen thing or another. But we hadn't really ever talked to each other. But she was there last week, so it was the first time that I ever really got to know her in a talky kind of get to know you way. Find out things about you. I found out that she collects strawberries, which is a funny thing. But I already at the beginning of that week, coming into it, I went into it just feeling really close to her. Oh, I know Yuko. I know her really well. You know, and I didn't know her at all. But just because of that sitting next to each other, I felt this real companionship with her that's different than you would under ordinary circumstances. And even without doing retreat practice, there's just something there's something about the relationships that we develop with people in a sangha. I've run into people here before who I had been in a sangha in a Zen community with, you know, 10 years ago, and they show up, and it's a different kind of reunion than you have with anybody else. You know, you've got all these different kinds of relationships in your lives. You know, we've got people that we know slightly in our families and old neighbors and people that we went to college with, and they're all a little bit different. And there's something unique and special about people that we've been in sangha with. And I think it has to do with going deeply together in silence and in the kind of solitude that we have when we're sitting together. There's a different kind of listening that occurs. There's a different kind of knowing that occurs. So that's my take on spiritual companions, both one-on-one and in groups, who listen as we go deeply. So those are the six. Those are the six key elements that people need to thrive spiritually. And when I read it, I was really moved by how similar it was between these traditions that are pretty different in a lot of ways, the Benedictine tradition and ours, but also, you know, it reminded me of really how similar we are in that one particular way. So I think that's what I want to say about that. Is there anybody who has any questions or anything else that they want to talk about? Yeah. All right.
Could you say something more about the appointment for the
relationship? Something more about that. That was the one that was actually the hardest for me, because at first I sort of recoiled against it a little bit, because I thought about it in terms of being that sort of American individualistic spirit that we all have, that gives us some trouble with Zen practice sometimes. But the more I thought about it, I thought it's not so much about becoming authentically who my personal ego space is, but shedding some of the false self that we surround ourselves with, I guess. That makes sense?
Authenticity
comes from vulnerability. I think you're right. Yeah, that vulnerability removes those separations that we feel. Yeah, I think that's true.
So this past week I went to a 3-day intensive undoing racism class, course, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of this going on in that. And I just wanted to know the part of cultivating compassion. I feel like I am very compassionate, but I was faced with people not wanting my compassion, I guess. So is there something that you can speak of?
Yeah. Compassion was actually a really hard thing for me to understand, because it has this we have this overlay or this idea of it meaning for one thing pity, and for another we think of it as being a way that helps us to cross some sort of divide between us and some other person. And so, but with true compassion, there isn't a divide. You find some way that you are right there with this other person despite what may seem like real differences. But you don't forget that this other person, or that you both have some really different world experiences, things that happened differently in your lives, you've been treated differently. And so you you don't want to feel that someone else is making that leap in a real kind of facile way, you know, a way that isn't authentic, you know. That compassion can have a real overlay, I think, of now I just lost the word. It can have a real overlay of patronizing, you know. And you really have to get that out of the way. You have to come at each other from a shared humanity, I think. And it's tricky. It's tricky. So someone over here.
I'm sorry.
No.
The way that I sometimes explain it to children is that it's the platinum rule of treating others how they want to be treated rather than how you want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
For what it's worth.
Yeah. Thank you. It's true.
So I had some thoughts along this line this week also. I think some people are more able to put themselves in the other person's situation and look back at whatever they're doing from that other person's eyes. This is a good skill, because otherwise compassion is just, it's too self-centered. It's kind of all me identifying with you instead of taking into account the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, there really is something about that not knowing, and that being able to understand that that I don't really know your, is not making that assumption that I really understand your particular situation that you've entered into this moment with, from all the causes and conditions of your life, is that I can't really know that, but I can still be with you. And that I have to approach that not from my point of view out, but understand that this other person is looking at me also.
I guess I'm saying it might be possible to understand what that other person sees when they look at you.
Yeah, and that can be a scary thought, can't it? Yeah. Yeah, Larry. It absolutely is. Yeah, when we talk about emptiness, and people want to ask about emptiness, you know, I always have to sort of finish that sentence of, we're empty of inherent self nature. You know, what is it that we're empty of? It's that there's really not that separation. And I think that the compassion practices are one of the best ways to realize that, because you see that kind of shared humanity. Yeah.
I have one thought, which is that to me, compassion is something you have. It's not something you give.
Yeah.
You can have it with people you've never met or never seen.
Yeah.
Which is not, I don't see that as criticism. It's a different way of thinking about what you do with it when you feel it. And likewise, all you can do is be there, and for the other person to accept that you're real and trustworthy, that's theirs to come to in response to who they say you are, and if they can trust that.
Yeah.
I think the word insight is kind of an important question, because if you're trying to be compassionate to someone, if you have some kind of insight to where they are, that really helps.
Yeah, that's
kind of know them and know what they would respond to as far as you're giving something to them, and what they wouldn't respond to. I think insight would be really important.
Yeah, and that's the wisdom side of it. You know. Yeah, Steve.
How about communicating to someone when you would appreciate the cessation of the compassion?
Say something more about that.
Well, I just don't know how to do that very well. I'm not very good at that.
So say it again. The limits of their...
Well, I mean, some people are overbearingly compassionate, which is certainly confused with
condescension. Condescension, they're kind of dripping with it.
Condescension, when it's embarrassing to say, you cease and desist, it's patronizing.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing for myself to say that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the dangers of working with compassion is that it is so easy to slip into patronizing and that condescension. And once you do, it's not compassion. It's kind of the opposite of compassion, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, someone over here had something. It was someone had, yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is really tough to talk about and to really try to understand. It seems like a real simple thing, but then it seems like a side of this prison that we're talking about, compassion. It almost seems, in some sense, too, the minute you try to be intentional about it, kind of losing something.
It's true.
Yeah. So, on the way here, I stepped into some a pile of stuff, and this lady, in all her compassion, said to me, "Don't you just hate it when that happens?" And I thought to myself, "Well, I actually didn't hate it until, well, now I'm thinking about hating it." I was thinking to myself, "Why I just kind of just continued walking in the grass until much of it came off?" But now I'm thinking about how much it sucks.
I think because I can sense that when your compassion becomes not more about understanding their situation, but when you get uncomfortable with the fact that they're suffering and you want to fix it.
Oh God, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They can sense, then you're not being authentic and real. You're being, "Oh, this is uncomfortable for me, and I'm going to need to fix this because this is not okay with me."
Yeah, and it's about not making assumptions. Not making assumptions about how somebody's feeling. You know, if they want you to know, they'll tell you. And, you know, they may or may not want to share that. And even if they do, you may not understand. But it's also, you know, to your point, it's also sort of not inserting that self into it. You know, it was just stepping in shit, that's all. That's all, and suddenly it was a bad, like it was a bad thing, right? Step in shit every day. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, when you get in that situation you were talking about, I think you sort of create this duality between you and somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think in Buddhism, you try to realize kind of an illusion, actually, or kind of interdependent person, meaning that you are something. But sometimes, when you have this kind of relationship, and create like this artificial duality, you know.
Yeah.
So, I'm not a parent, it's a person, and it's different. So, I have to help the families.
Yeah.
Everybody's serving the same group, and they're serving the same place.
Yeah. And sometimes you see that duality, that separation of self and other, pretty well when there's this big hunk of compassion sitting right in between the two of you. You know, sometimes that's the best way to see it, when you see there's this thing sitting there. And sometimes it's this big ball of compassion, and you go, "Oh, there it is." So,
yeah. Listen.
Yeah. With the incline the ear of your heart. The ear of your heart. So I want to go to some announcements. Before we do that, I want to give you an invitation. Next month we're doing our annual retreat down in Hokioji, the southeastern tip of Minnesota. And the retreat goes from September 18th through 23rd. It's a Tuesday evening through a Sunday noonish. And you can come either for the full 5 days or just for the weekend. And if you haven't ever been to Hokkyoji, you just can't quite imagine. It's this beautiful place. It's in the bluff country. And so you're surrounded by these beautiful bluffs, and it's very quiet, so it's really different than sitting in the city. Or it's a different kind of noisy. You know, there's animals and bird noises instead of cars going by. So it's, to our city ears, it's very quiet. And it's also, the other thing about Hokkyoji is that it's a Zen practice community. So those of you who were here a couple months ago when Dokai Jorgensen talked, Dokai is the guiding teacher at Hokkyoji, and one of our priests here, Susan Nelson, is a resident there with her husband. And so that community aspect of it just adds this really wonderful depth of practice to being there. And I just wanted to highlight that among the announcements, because it is such a wonderful place, and we get the opportunity once a year to go down there as a sangha and practice. And I would really encourage you to join us if you can. There's a sign-up sheet out on the porch. Okay. Yeah.
And I think for anybody who's interested, it would give you an opportunity to experience all six key elements to thrive spiritually.
That's right. That's right. And then some. And also nature.
Yes.